Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. On this podcast, we present a session from the EDUCAUSE 2012 annual conference. The presentation is entitled, The New Normal and the Need for Adaptation in Higher Education. Our speaker is Kimberly Tooby, Vice President and Senior Credit Officer for Moody's.
Okay, let's see how my technical skills are, if I can get these slides back. Okay, there we go. Okay, great, happy to be here, and I'm really flattered that you're all here. It's tough having the session right after lunch when you're probably stayed up a little late last night and feeling a little tired right now, and in case you haven't been outside, it's 70 degrees and sunny and gorgeous out, but thanks for all being here. And thanks for the introduction, Nadine. Again, I'm Kim Tooby. I'm a senior analyst on Moody's Higher Education and Not-for-Profit Ratings team, based in our Boston office, staying for the night, even though I wasn't planning to, but flights seem to be canceled back to the East Coast. I work on a team of about 20 analysts, and we cover a large portfolio of bond ratings for not-for-profit and public colleges and universities across the United States. And I'll talk a little bit more about what Moody's does. I cover the full range of different types of higher education institutions, from AAA-rated Ivy League institutions to much smaller public and private colleges that are heavily tuition-dependent. So maybe just by a show of hands, this is a little bit of a different audience than we typically speak to. I meet one-on-one a lot with different colleges and universities. We speak a lot to boards of trustees. We speak at Nakubo and other types of higher education forums that attract more the financial side, chief financial officers, controllers. So this is a little bit of a different audience. I'm just curious, how many of you out here represent public colleges and universities? Okay. And privates? Okay, great. Any for-profits? Any for-profit higher education institutions? Okay. A few hands. Good. And how about in terms of size, the size of your organizations? How many of you are at what you would consider large organizations? Maybe the revenue base is over $1 billion, research organizations. Okay. And those of you that are at smaller organizations, liberal arts colleges. Okay. All right, that's helpful. Great. So just in terms of an agenda, I'm going to go over what we do at Moody's, give you a quick overview of the higher education rating activity, talk a little bit about our higher education rating methodology, how do we assign a bond rating, talk about our higher education outlook, and really the underpinnings for the outlook, the key revenue and expense drivers, and what the key credit strengths and challenges are for the sector, as well as the way that we're seeing a higher education adapt to this new normal. And finally, after we talk about all the challenges and all the negative stuff, we'll try and end on a positive note so you leave here with a smile on your face and talk about reasons for optimism, why higher education still is a very strong business model and a great industry to be in. So just a little stroll down memory lane, a little brain teaser to get the juices flowing. Maybe you can all reminisce for a second about what it was like when you were in high school or when you were in college, when you were doing the applying process, what your experience was. You don't have to close your eyes and think about it, but just try and think back to what the experience was like and compare and contrast that to what you're seeing now on your college campuses, whether it's where you're working or where your children are applying to school. When you're looking at the college experience, how has that changed? And just a few graphics to get the thoughts going. Not to give away my age, college experience is still very different from when I went to college. We didn't have email, no laptops, applied by typewriter, no online applications. I, up until my senior year, had a bunk bed and shared a very small room with one college roommate, very different from what I see on campuses now when I go around dorms and see lovely, lovely apartments. I remember using the landline all the time, calling my parents, freaking out about how many minutes I had used and calling them. No cell phones, no texting, no tweeting, no Facebook, all notes taken on with paper and pen. And even laptops now are starting to look a little bit outdated. If you don't have an iPad, a laptop looks like a big clunker. So in a relatively short amount of time, whether it's 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 50 years since you graduated, the college-going experience has changed dramatically. And I'll give you a minute to just take a look at these two quotes that really caught my eye. One is from the U.S. Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, and the second quote is from the president of Northeastern University, which is a private university based in Boston. I'll give you a second to look at those. And the real point is that they're both outlining the need for change, and change not at a snail's pace, but a real urgency and a need for rapid adaptation. And we're going to be talking a lot today about the higher education business model. I'm not sure how many of you went to the earlier session that was in this room at 10:30, Disruptive Innovation. It was very good, and I think a lot of the points that Mr. Horn was commenting on will dovetail nicely into the comments that I make today. Just quick by way of background, sometimes I say I work for Moody's and people don't know what that is. Some people have thought I said I work in the movies, but I work for Moody's. And for better or for worse, Moody's has got a lot of coverage over the past few years, but we are a credit rating agency. We assign credit ratings to debt instruments issued by for-profit corporations, not-for-profits, higher education, local governments, states, housing authorities, you name it. We also publish a lot of credit and economic-related data. And the bond rating is really meant to capture the ability and the legal obligation of an entity, in this case the university, to pay its debt service payments over time. And the rating scale goes all the way from AAA all the way down to C, where you would see colleges that are really in financial distress and potentially looking at default on a bond or even longer-term bankruptcy. So in addition to meeting with institutions and covering this large portfolio of higher education institutions, we also publish a lot of special comments, topics like endowments, endowment management, liquidity, intercollegiate athletics, you name it, anything that's really credit-related to higher education, we've probably published on it in some way, shape, or form. So a few graphs here just to give you a sense of the rating spectrum for both the publics and the private colleges and universities. This gives you an overview of how many institutions we rate. We have over 500 unique bond ratings on colleges and universities, about 228 four-year public colleges and universities, and 285 private colleges. And just to point out, for example, if, let's say, SUNY, the State University of New York, issued debt, they do it as one bond rating. So even though they might have 64 campuses, a system typically counts as one rating, just to give you a little sense of the public universities that we work with. And this really doesn't capture a very large number of institutions that are out there that are really the small, typically the private universities that are small, heavily tuition dependent, very thin endowments, and not typically issuing debt through the capital market. So they might be using a private bank loan or doing some type of private placement. So there is this whole other universe of higher education institutions that we don't necessarily work with directly. And this is sort of the main takeaways from these slides. You can see that there are more AAA-rated private universities, but the privates have a much longer tail. When you go down to the BAA, and SG stands for speculative grade, junk bond, below investment grade, whatever you want to call it, there are a lot of weaker private colleges out there. The good news is we've never had a default on a bond by a higher education institution that Moody's has rated. So that just highlights the credit strength of the entire sector. Okay. A few comments on rating stability. Some people ask me what's happening in terms of rating movement over the past few years. It's been a really tough couple of years for higher education. Endowments are thinner. There's pressure on tuition growth. Federally funded research is not growing. Have you seen a ton of rating downgrades? And I think these two slides, which break up the public universities versus the private university rating activity over the past 5 years, the green bar represents the number of rating reviews we do where there's just an affirmation of the rating. The rating stays the same. And so you can see here the big takeaway is that there's quite a bit of rating stability. across the higher education sector, even over a challenging couple of years. But you can see that in 2009, 10, 11, and 12, the bottom portions of the bars, the red and the orange pieces, those represent rating downgrades or outlook changes down, have picked up. But there's still, they are surpassing the number of upgrades, but I would just reemphasize that the rating affirmations are the most common rating outcome. Okay, so how do we assign a bond rating to a college or university? Just curious, does anyone out here know if their college or university is rated and what the rating is? You don't have to say it. I'm just curious if you're familiar with your college's bond rating. Okay, so here's a fairly colorful depiction of how we go about assigning a rating. There are really five broad rating factors that we're looking at. We're looking at market strength, balance sheet strength, long-term operating performance, legal security, and debt structure. And ultimately, we've really put governance and management in the center, because that's the starting point for any rating, the strength of the governance and the management. We did publish about a year ago a special comment called Top 10 Reasons for a Rating Upgrade or Downgrade, which really highlights the key factors that drive a rating movement. But these are sort of the primary factors. I just wanted to zero in a little bit more on the one in the center, governance and management, because this is a tougher, more qualitative factor that's perhaps more difficult to put into words. We try and opine on governance and management quite a lot and include that in our published reports on your colleges and universities. And I'll tell you, when bondholders call me, or investors who are holding university bonds, it's one of the first questions I get. What's your assessment of management? We don't have access, these investors don't necessarily have access to college presidents or boards of trustees, and they want to know, what do you think? How is their long-term strategic planning? What type of financial modeling are they doing? So this, we did publish about a year ago a nice publication that lays out a framework for how we assess governance and management, but this slide just highlights a few of the points. Looking for diversification on the board, a lot of diversification of sector expertise, strong accountability and oversight, self-assessment, but really realistic self-assessment, and wanting to see who you benchmark yourselves against, term limits, conflict of interest policies being implemented, a mix of veterans and newcomers, and so on. So I would just say that when we were looking at the rating spectrum, when you look at the lower end of the rating spectrum and you look at those organizations that have fallen into essentially the junk bond category, very, very common, the common thread between all of them is weak governance and management. We've often met in those situations with CEOs or presidents who can be quite domineering, not to say that they don't have good intentions, but they may be quite visionary. There's often poor financial reporting, not very good checks and balances, no real implementation of term limits on the board, and not a good sense of succession planning for the senior leadership. So now to talk just a little bit about the outlook that we have for higher education. Moody's publishes an annual outlook at the beginning of each calendar year. And it's not meant to forecast the upgrades and downgrades of ratings. It's really meant to highlight the strengths and challenges that we see in the sector over the next year or two or even longer term. And I'm not going to go through all of these, but we're going to be touching on a lot of them. We do have a mixed outlook right now for the higher education sector. And we have a stable outlook really for a much smaller portion of colleges and universities that we rate. Those are the diversified, market-leading universities. They tend to be the largest in the portfolio. They also happen to be the wealthiest. They have extremely strong market positions, extremely strong student demand, typically very large research portfolios, large endowments, good liquidity, and they are typically but not exclusively rated in the AAA or AA rating category. On the other end of the spectrum, we do have a negative outlook for really the larger majority of the portfolio. And those are the more heavily tuition-dependent, state appropriation-dependent institutions, those that have a more regional draw, thinner balance sheets, thinner liquidity, and typically weaker operating performance. and recognizing that this is really showing two ends of the spectrum. We recognize there's a lot of gray area in between. Higher education is a very diverse sector. It's sometimes very hard to make blanket statements about the entire sector because you could be dealing with entirely different types of institutions, and we recognize that the challenges are not evenly distributed across the sector. So just to quickly go through a few of the major risks that we foresee for the higher education sector, starting with those that are really a little bit more established. These aren't new things that you're just hearing about for the first time, but the macroeconomic headwinds really intensifying this flight to quality and value. And I'm going to show you a couple of slides in a minute about unemployment rate, if you haven't heard enough about that over the past 2 years. But unemployment, reduced household net wealth, and really that all contributing, if there's one takeaway you take from this entire session, is that we foresee the biggest credit challenge for higher education being this weakened capacity to grow net tuition revenue and student charges. The growth that we saw over the past 20 years is not going to continue. We've really hit a tuition tipping point. The other point is that revenue growth is really not happening across the spectrum. It's not just the student charges and the net tuition revenue, but really on every front, whether it's fundraising being more challenged, federally sponsored research we know is not growing. For those of you that work at endowment-dependent institutions, you know that your endowments have taken a hit over the past few years, and thus the endowment draw is pressured. So really, revenue growth across all fronts is challenged. And the final thought is just the backlog capital spending. It's been interesting to see and meet with senior management teams over the past few years, and there's really been the brakes have been put on over the past few years in terms of capital spending from our perspective. And this really potentially threatens the market. When you are deferring maintenance on your facilities, not necessarily just not building new facilities, but you're building up deferred maintenance, and you know that is critical to attracting students and attracting families, that presents a real longer-term challenge. And I know from going on literally hundreds of campus tours across the U.S., I hear so many institutions say, if we can just get the student and the families on our campus and they can really see the campus, see the buildings, meet the faculty, have that one-on-one contact, that's really critical to getting them here. And so the backlog capital spending remains a longer-term credit challenge. Just to quickly touch on some of the developing risks, and we're going to really go into some of these in more detail, especially the online growth. But the growth of the online education and the new technology platforms is definitely going to create some winners and some losers across the sector. I'll save most of my comments there, but an interesting turn of events over the past year has been the entrance of really some of the top-tier, best-known institutions into the online world, an area that they really hadn't even touched before. And that's a pretty pivotal development where they are really trying to get in front of any type of disruption to their traditional residential business model. Also on the regulatory front, we're watching very closely what's happening with federal regulation. There's obviously increased amount of public and political scrutiny about how higher education operates as a sector, a demand for better transparency, better disclosure, more outcomes data, because families and students really want to be able to see a return on their investment. And even on the accreditation front, we've seen some interesting cases where there have been some institutions sort of put on an accreditation watch. And so we're looking at that very closely. But Washington, D.C. definitely seems much more interested in higher education. And finally, just this growing need for bolder leadership, better communication between the senior leaders at a college or a university and the board of trustees, as well as the faculty and the families. Needing to really see this bold leadership, we've seen some in the media some very interesting examples and attention drawn to management and governance, whether it's University of Virginia very recently, Penn State, certain stories of governance and management and really analyzing that very closely. And on the public university side, this drive to really become increasingly market-driven, to operate less and less like a government agency and to continue to act like a more market-driven, almost a private university as the revenue share changes. So those are a few comments on our outlook for higher education. I just wanted to pause for a minute and give you a second to think about the diverse stakeholders basically investing in higher education. You don't have stockholders. You do have bondholders in most cases. But the different, and I just put up a short list. I'm sure you could keep this list going, whether it's the student families, the faculty and staff, federal government, state government, donors, granting organizations, bondholders. Maybe just give you 60 seconds while I take a sip of water and just think through what each of these constituencies' main concerns are at this point. If you could sum it up in a sentence, sum it up in a thought, what are each of these constituencies thinking about? When I was just brainstorming what their main concerns and priorities are, as a student, how much will my tuition increase next year and over the 4 years? How much will it cost me to graduate from here? And will I graduate? Will I graduate in 4 years? There's a lot of scrutiny of especially the six-year graduation rates and not only the ability to recruit students, but to retain them and have them graduate. And ultimately, will I get a job when I graduate from here with this degree? Faculty and staff, will my salary increase next year? What will happen with my benefits? Will there be layoffs? Will there be expense containment? How will that impact morale at the institution? From a government perspective, how will state appropriations be used? And even more so now with states focusing on, as public universities in particular, are focused on diversifying their student bodies and grabbing more and more students from out of state, a real state focus on what will be the longer-term mix of in-state and out-of-state students, and then should there be certain limitations, statutory limitations in some cases, on what percentage of students you can grab from out-of-state and what those tuition increases can be. Donors and granting organizations taking a very close look at how efficiently the organizations run, and will there be any longer-term changes to charitable donations tax exemption? And finally, from a bondholder's or a rating agency perspective, will I be repaid? If I invest in this college and lend them money, will I be repaid over the 30-year life of a bond? And am I receiving a high enough interest rate to compensate me for the risk that I'm taking on? So just to kind of think from different perspectives as we're going through the next few slides. The first in a series of graphs that I have here, this is probably not news to you, but just to sort of set the stage about the macroeconomic piece of the picture and really supporting the notion that consumer confidence is still fairly rattled, and that has really contributed to a very intense spotlight on the pace of tuition increases and the need for financial aid. On the left, we have a demonstration of the depressed household net worth. And on the right, the persistently high unemployment rate. We know it's coming down, but it's very slow. So the home equity situation, the volatility that we've seen in the stock market over the past few years has really resulted in fairly fragile consumer confidence. And more than ever, families and students are focused on value. Again, they want to see that ROI, that return on their investment. And again, just to reemphasize that the largest credit challenge that we'll foresee for the entire higher education sector will be this weakened capacity to grow net tuition revenue growth. And we, for years and years, had slides in our presentations that says, has higher education hit a tuition tipping point? Have we hit a tuition tipping point? I think we can pretty clearly say we've hit a tuition tipping point. I'll show you some more data on that. A key credit strength of the higher education sector continues to be the nation's still very strong consensus that higher education as an investment is very valuable. And here we present the differential in the unemployment and the annual earnings by educational attainment. So you can see that those with a college degree have lower unemployment rates and higher annual income, and this is comparing 2011 and 2007, so you can see how that's changed over the past few years. But the expected financial rewards of higher education cannot be denied. There have been critics that have emerged questioning really this assumption, but our feeling is that there really is no broadly viable substitute for just the core higher education experience.
There's really a lack of threats and a lack of substitutes for that core undergraduate, in some cases residential or even as a commuter institution experience. I know the earlier session commented on some of the real takeaways. And when I travel to college campuses and see students talking to one another, talking with faculty, meeting, excited, engaged, it's really palpable. It's a chance for personal development, career networking, really becoming engaged and becoming more and more prepared for your life and for future careers. So that is really the key credit strength of the higher education sector. Just to start by talking a little bit about the market dynamics and how it's really not evenly distributed when you look at the entire higher education sector and look across the entire country. The starting point for any rating that we assign, and when we're sitting in rating committee, we're basically saying, if I was a student, why would I go here? What's the niche? What's some sort of the distinguishing factors that this institution has that the other institution 5 miles down the road does not have? So that's really the starting point. The demand, we'll look at in a second at a map of the demographics for the number of high school graduates across the U.S. It's interesting. It's really the strong demand for higher education, but it's not very evenly distributed across the United States. The student body is increasingly diverse from all perspectives, whether it's economic, socioeconomic, ethnically diverse, different ages, people going back with families, and all of this diversity has really lent itself to a demand for increased educational flexibility. The online piece of it is really just one piece of it, but wanting to have more flexibility in terms of when classes are offered. I was just recently up in upstate New York touring a campus during the summer, and the CFO was lamenting, isn't it a shame that it's gorgeous out right now and there's no students on the campus? This is the most beautiful time of year in upstate New York, and we're sending them home or off to jobs for the summer. So perhaps there will be more flexibility in terms of when classes are offered, whether it's through the winter, through the summer, in the evening, even on Fridays, just using those classroom facilities and building flexibility. And finally, just this ongoing bifurcation of demand that we're seeing. It's really interesting. Over the past few years, the two types of organizations, if I had to bucket them, where we've seen ongoing, very strong, sustained demand from students. First, the top-tier organizations, those with the really globally known brand names, where families and students feel like they're going to get their return on investment by getting a degree from this institution. And the second is really the more affordable institutions. And the way that organizations have been competing and the shifting in demand is really interesting, where the privates now are competing more and more with the publics, the four-year publics. And the four-year publics are now competing even more and more with the two-year community colleges, where a student may say, I'll go for 2 years to the local community college. It will save a lot of money for my family, and then I'll transfer after 2 years. So just this highlights a couple of the major market dynamics that we're seeing. This is the map that I was promising, presenting. It's actually data from WICHE, and I don't know if you're familiar with it, the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education. Just put it into a map format. So you can see where the strongest projected growth for the number of high school graduates over the next decade, so through 2022, is. It's not looking very good for the Northeast, although New Jersey looks okay. But most of the Northeast is red and expecting less than 0% projected growth in high school graduates. Also, parts of the Midwest will definitely be challenged. And as a result, as we meet with enrollment teams and financial aid teams, they're sending more and more recruiters to the Southwest, to Florida, to California. And you just hear the same story over and over, and everyone's recruiting from the same area. So, again, the question is not necessarily whether you can just recruit them. You might be in upstate New York, you might be able to recruit someone from Florida, but can you retain them for 4 years and have them graduate? And so this has really impacted recruitment, retention, financial aid strategies quite a bit. So here's a little bit of a provocative question. Is the higher education model broken? The equation doesn't really seem to work. We see pressure on really all revenue fronts, not only the student charges, but federally sponsored research, state funding, endowment spending, fundraising for some, and everyone knows that expenses just keep going up, whether it's financial aid, energy and healthcare costs, fixed costs, including tenured faculty, increased debt service payments because you've borrowed a lot over the past years. The equation is challenging. Our feeling is that the model, the business model of higher education as an industry is not broken. It is a strong business model, but it is absolutely in need of some fine-tuning and some tweaking pretty quickly. And so now we're going to talk a little bit more about ways that we're seeing organizations adapt. But this is definitely a situation of institutions doing more with less. So again, just another quick visual on, we collect so much data from the higher education institutions that we work with. We're typically working with audited financial data. Most higher education institutions have a fiscal year end of June 30th. But this segments out the smaller institutions, those with $150 million or less on the left-hand side of the page, and on the right, the larger institutions with more than $150 million of revenue. And you can see here the growing percent of colleges with operating revenue below 2% in any given year. So 2%, when you peel out inflation, you're basically looking at, these are the institute, this is the proportion that are not experiencing real growth in their operating revenue every year. And this is not a sustainable situation. The main takeaway, look at starting 2009, those numbers just spike up. That revenue growth really slowed. And the other main takeaway is that the smaller institutions appear to have it tougher. The larger institutions have more economies of scale, more revenue diversification, more programmatic and academic diversification, and the smaller institutions may be more challenged. Just to run through a few of the different revenue segments, the first, this is a comparison really for the public universities, the four-year public universities. The percentage of their revenue coming from government appropriations is the red line, and student revenue is the green line. And this is just the perfect picture showing how that cost shifting has been occurring over the past 10 or 11 years. And the federal stimulus funding, the ARRA funding, provided a little bit of relief. It provided some breathing room, gave public universities a little bit of time to adjust, but the day of reckoning is now here. For most, the ARRA funding is gone. And it's time to sort of rethink the business model, think through the sources and uses of your funds. And we know that states are challenged. States have their own problems. Their rainy day funds are depleted. Their tax revenues are coming in lower. There's much greater demand for the public services that they provide. So, you kind of wonder how much further down this red line can continue to go. And on the tuition front, I've been saying over and over that we think the biggest credit challenge that higher education will face is this weakened capacity to grow net tuition revenue. And this slide shows the percent of colleges each year that experienced a year-over-year decline in net tuition per student. Now, these are, again, just the private colleges. We just took a snapshot. And this is just the A1 or lower rated institutions. So we peeled out the AAAs, we peeled out the AAs, the wealthiest institutions. I mean, there are instances where Harvard and Yale and Princeton have expanded their financial aid more from a mission-driven perspective or more because they feel there's a lot of political scrutiny on how high their tuition is, but they have the funds to subsidize and to pay out additional scholarships. So this is focused on A1 and lower rated institutions. And again, same thing as what we just saw in the revenue picture, starting in fiscal year 10, those numbers really pop up, and more institutions are basically not growing their net tuition per student, and that median discount rate, which is the blue bar, is really jumping up for these institutions. So just to summarize, whether the reasons are self-imposed or whether they're externally posed, this pace of net tuition revenue growth and the pressure on it are really a key credit focus. And just, again, on the topic of net tuition revenue growth, there's been a lot of media focus more recently and a lot of political focus on the growth of student loan debt. Lots and lots of newspaper articles quoting a lot of different numbers. I'm not going to go into too much detail here. We're paying a lot of attention to it. I mean, the ultimate question is higher education in a bubble? Sort of what we saw with the real estate sector Are families really leveraging up? Leveraging up. These students are coming out with a tremendous amount of debt. We've also been paying a lot of attention to the cohort default rates. Here you can see that in 2003, the percent of student loan debt as a share of total consumer debt was about 3%. It has grown to about 8% now. That growth is concerning. 8%, though, still, I think, represents a relatively small slice of the pie when you consider mortgages, auto loans, home equity loans, other types of debt that families are taking on. 8% of the entire pie is relatively thin. Not to go into too much detail here, but the good news from our perspective is that the public colleges and universities that we work with, as well as the private colleges that we work with, the private not-for-profits, so the two lower bars, those graduating students appear to be taking on less debt than what we're seeing in the for-profit higher education sector. And also, when you look at the cohort default rates, we're looking closely at the two-year cohort default rates, the default rates tend to be much lower for the public and the not-for-profit colleges and more highly concentrated at the for-profit institutions. So big takeaway, higher education is definitely in focus in terms of public scrutiny, the amount of debt that students are taking on. I would just caution, I think even in an earlier session today, I saw the chart of the tuition price going up, and there's so much focus on sticker price. And as you probably know, there are students who pay the sticker price, but it's not the majority of students who are paying the sticker price. And it seems that a lot of the media articles really focus on the $50,000 sticker price at an Ivy League institution. We, from a credit perspective, really focus on the net tuition revenue. So when you take out financial aid, you take out scholarships, what is the net tuition per student that a family is paying or that a college is receiving every year? Because you know that everyone has a different pricing model. You may have a high sticker price, high financial aid model, low sticker price, low financial aid. We're focusing ultimately on what the net tuition revenue per student is. In terms of expense growth, let me just check and see how we're doing on time. In terms of expense growth, colleges have really put on the brakes over the past few years. Again, this is educational expenses per student, and that's peeling out research expenses, patient care expenses, as well as auxiliary expenses. Starting in 2009, actually dipping negative in 2010, a decline in educational expenses per student, after years and years of growth of expenses at a very rapid rate. And I know I've sat with management teams, and I've heard the nitty-gritty. I've heard the holiday party was canceled. We don't order beverages for everyone. Really the nitty-gritty. But really focusing a little bit more broadly on the areas where higher education has gotten quite creative over the past few years. You could say that the low-hanging fruit, the easy things to do, sort of obvious, normal-type things to contain expenses, that's been done. So what do you do now when you're tough, when you're really challenged with the tougher situations for containing expenses? And here's just a few. I'm not going to go through all of them. But greater partnerships and collaborations across universities. For a sector that I have to say has not always been known for a tremendous amount of partnerships and collaborations. But we've been seeing purchasing cooperatives, offering of dual enrollment, shared degree programs across institutions, even within universities, seeing more shared services, more centralization. I just was meeting with a very large research university the other day, and they said, we've basically taken out an entire administrative layer across the entire university, questioning, do you need an HR function for each school within this very large decentralized research university? Do we need a marketing team for each school? Do we need a fundraising team for each school? How can we share services? How can we become increasingly efficient? On the consolidation front, not too much that we've seen on the consolidation front. I also work with not-for-profit hospitals, and the merger and acquisition activity is unbelievable on the healthcare side. In higher ed, not so much. Merger and acquisition activity. We saw some interesting examples. SUNY, which has many campuses throughout upstate New York, actually has a sort of a sharing of a president, three presidents covering six campuses. So not a full-out merger or acquisition, but more sharing of senior leadership, and we'll see how that goes. And actually, in Georgia, we saw some consolidation within the public university system within Georgia. So I definitely want to leave a little bit of time for questions and finish up on the technology piece, because as I said, we're tracking very closely what's happening with these MOOCs, the massive open online courses. Very interesting turn of events over the past year, where some of the strongest market-leading institutions, which had really never even touched online education, now delving in by forming collaborations. Again, we've seen edX and Coursera and larger groups, and this is a pretty pivotal development because these institutions are potentially trying to get in front of this changing technology, which longer term could destabilize their what had traditionally been an undergraduate residential, you're there in person type model. So I think data on this topic was shown earlier in the day. The Sloan Consortium publishes some very interesting data on the percentage of students that are at least taking one online course, and that's the green bar here. You can see that that percentage has grown over time, and what they're projecting is that that green bar may grow to be about 50% of the bar by 2016. So whether it's through a MOOC or through some other type of online class, the expectation is that the online will continue to become increasingly important. From a credit perspective, what we're watching in terms of online development is obviously the potential for revenue generation and revenue diversification. Right now, these MOOCs, as far as I know, are not actually charging any tuition or fees to participate. That could change over time, even if it's a small fee. If you have 100,000 students enrolled, that could be some real revenue. Longer-term economies of scale, operating efficiency, bringing down that educational expense per student. Very focused on global reputation, not necessarily for Harvard and MIT going out and doing this, but perhaps those that are known more nationally but not known as globally, the ability to break down those geographic barriers and really get your name out there and become better well-known. So the extent of the longer-term credit impacts on the individual universities is definitely going to vary widely. Our thinking is that probably many will end up somewhere within the blended field, doing some mix of in-person classes as well as some mix of online classes. And probably there will be some out there that will just, maybe you think of a very prestigious liberal arts college like an Amherst or a Williams. Maybe those types of institutions will really maintain their niche. That what we provide is really that traditional undergraduate in-person residential experience, and that will be their niche as things evolve. This next slide, I'm not going to go into all of this, and probably the font is a little bit small to see here, but we're basically breaking down some of the opportunities and risks by market segment. If you're interested, we published a credit perspective on how the online higher education, on the longer-term impact would be. So to try and end on a positive note, we've talked a lot about the challenges, the challenge to grow tuition, the challenge to recruit students more globally, the challenge of new disruptive technologies and how to absorb them. But a few reasons for optimism. The first is that aggregate demand for U.S. higher education is very strong. Countries across the world are looking at the U.S. higher education model. They're trying to recruit U.S. students. They're trying to recruit U.S. faculty and trying to compete more and more directly with U.S. higher education institutions. And the second point that we emphasize is that long-term family planning and saving for college does not happen overnight. College saving is not usually thought of as a discretionary expense. So if you have a 529 plan and you want to send your child to college, one bad year in the stock market is not typically going to make a family completely change that idea and tell their child not to go to college. It's not typically a discretionary expense. It's a good business model. As I said, I work in healthcare, and if I had to choose between two business models, I would definitely choose higher education. It's a lot better to get paid first and then provide the service than to provide the service and then try and figure out how you're going to get reimbursed by a payer. I would definitely much rather have deferred revenue on my balance sheet than having a big account receivable. So it's ultimately a very good business model, few defined benefit pension plans, not to get into detail there, but the healthcare sector has some very large post-retirement liabilities that depress their balance sheets and really limit operational flexibility in higher education has, for the most part, except for a few large examples, has avoided the defined benefit pension situation. Philanthropy remains a core credit strength of the higher education sector. You forget that. We say, oh, gifts are going down, gifts are going down. The fact that you're even getting gifts is amazing. I work with state analysts, local government analysts. They say these charitable donations are unbelievable. And there's stories coming out every day, multi-million-dollar campaigns, multi-billion-dollar campaigns still going on. So philanthropy really remains a key credit strength of the sector. And finally, there still is room for expense containment and a lot of creativity in capital planning. And we've really seen across the spectrum from AAA rated all the way down the line, management teams really stepping up to a challenging situation, being very creative, very proactive to put their institutions on very stable financial footing. And universities continue to be very important economic engines within their communities. So those are sort of the major underpinnings and some reasons for optimism to hopefully leave on a good note. So with that, I think we might have time for a question or two, if there are any. I think there might be microphones up here, so that way everyone can hear.
Comments. I don't know if this is on.
Is it on?
Is it on? I enjoyed your comments. Could you comment, you showed the map of the United States and the demand and the differences by region, but how do you see the international demand for college courses and college degrees impacting the market and impacting the credit rating?
Yeah, the international demand, that's a great question. And I mean, I hear from institutions in the middle of Missouri, Nebraska. I mean, they're going out and they're recruiting. They're recruiting from China. They're recruiting from India, as well as a diverse number of other countries. And I think that's a really interesting point as you focus more not on just regional recruitment, but broadening and thinking not only out of state, but now out of country more and more. We've been tracking very closely that international growth. I mean, it's largest and most prominent at the best-known institutions. And a lot of it is still on the professional and graduate side, but we're seeing more and more for the undergraduate international student demand. And then our focus from a credit perspective and a net tuition revenue perspective is on the financial aid. Often those students are coming to universities and they are full-pay students. Some of the larger, wealthiest institutions are now offering financial aid for international students, but a lot are still recruiting those students and bringing them in as full-pay students. So that's an interesting trend.
So that's a positive, I would
on the credit side?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. It's a really high microphone.
So you showed the chart of the state. I'm from a large public research university.
Okay.
And you showed the two lines,
that one
of the funding from the state going down. And you made the comment that tuition has topped out. And so, yet you say that the business model is strong. And so could you articulate on that a little more? Because if we can't increase tuition and we don't get funding from the state, our costs continue to go up, but our revenue stream isn't going to be able to keep pace.
Right.
And so I'd like to understand the comment that the business model is strong. And secondly, are you hearing any really creative thinking around the business model? We all heard this morning, or many of us, the opening speaker who talked about other industries that have changed radically as a result of technology, like the newspaper industry, the recording industry, the movie industry. Mm-hmm. And they have different business models now. Streaming movies into homes has a big effect on how many people are going to theaters, online newspapers, online books, and it did change the business model of those industries. Mm-hmm. And so don't you think, given this picture and what's happening with technology, that there might be significant radical change in the business model? And is anyone talking about that as you're out with other universities?
Okay, good questions. I'll try and be succinct. I mean, My first thought is that this is clearly showing the cost sharing and that students and families are picking up a lot of what's going away on the state appropriation front. That being said, when you look at the net tuition revenue per student for public universities, it is much, much lower than private higher education. So there's still potentially a lot of pricing power, especially among the largest, best-known public universities, potential, unless there are statutory limitations on how much you can increase tuition, and some states do have, in some ways, tied the hands of public universities to not increase tuition, you know, by a certain percent every year. But there's still, our thinking is that there's still quite a bit of untapped pricing power in the public higher education sector. So I think that kind of comments on your first question. I mean, the other point I would just make is that public universities are still much further behind than privates in terms of other private sources of fundraising. The capital campaigns that we now see coming out of public university foundations and public universities are much larger than we'd ever seen in the past. So focusing on garnering private support, whether it's from corporations, private foundations, individual donors, tapping alumni, the private support is becoming an even, I don't have that line on this chart, but if you saw the private support, not from the families and the students, but from other community leaders, the foundations, I think that's becoming, that's sort of the third leg of the stool that is helping to subsidize the cost of higher education. I mean, in terms of the business model, I think the online education is probably the most disruptive piece. The fact that that could dramatically bring down the educational expense per student is the most disruptive piece. I mean, we've heard, you said, have you heard of other kind of major game changers in terms of higher education? I mean, the T word, tenure, is a big one, where I've heard even some of the best-known institutions, at least just sort of touching that third rail in even thinking about the concept of tenured faculty and that fixed expense, whether there's more adjunct faculty or something to build in more expense flexibility so you can ramp up, build down where you need to. And I just think the whole concept of shared services is becoming so much more prevalent. I work with a lot of large research universities where every tub on its own bottom, every school functions on its own, you keep your own profit, and everyone's just sort of doing their own thing. So it's like 10 schools within one university. This focus on shared services, centralization, coordination, increased efficiency, I think is a big game changer. Yeah, I'm happy to stay later and talk one-on-one if there are additional questions, but I think we're out of time. Thank you.